welcome to another podcast episode. Today on the show, I had Dr. Amir Hussain, who is a postdoc at the University of Leicester in the field of respiratory pharmacology. He also has a PhD in pharmacology as well from De Montfort University. Bit of a different episode, this one. We spoke more about the failures Amir had as a PhD student and how he overcame them, and now how he's using YouTube to demonstrate his failures and how he overcame these experiences. So without further ado, let's get straight into the podcast. All right, we are live on the Festa Show here with another podcast episode. This is episode number 11 now. How are we doing, Amir?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me. Hope you're going to be good fun. Looking forward to it, definitely.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on.
No problem.
Let's get straight into it. Do you want to just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, what you studied at undergrad? And I'm only asking you this because I know you went straight to PhD. What you did at PhD as well?
So between 2011 and 14, I did my first degree in biomedical science at De Montfort University. Then I went straight into my PhD in pharmacology, which was on anti-angiogenic therapy. So looking at trying to inhibit this angiogenesis formation, which is related to cancer progression. And that was between 2014 and 18. And then since 2018, I've been working as a postdoc for the University of Leicester in respiratory pharmacology. So looking at more how certain asthma medications for severe asthmatics become kind of mute, and what are the resistance and the issues as to why that. That's my summary of what I've been up to essentially for the past decade, since 2011, yeah, time's flying.
No, that's nice. At undergrad then, so you studied biomedical science? And when you were studying that, what really made you interested in science and to actually think, okay, maybe I would like to become a researcher and potentially go to...
There was a few reasons, actually. Those, my peers and my colleagues around me who were in biomedical science or in related courses, so like pharmacy, nursing, midwifery, and related courses like that, I knew for me personally that I didn't want to have a repetitive job. So something that was 9 to 5, same thing every day. And that's something that I knew I wouldn't enjoy, despite it maybe paying well or might be slightly easier perhaps. It's something I knew I wouldn't enjoy long term. So around my second year in biomedical science, I started to think along those lines, that my head started to screw on a bit better. And by the time I got to my third year, I was doing obviously your classical final year research project. And I enjoyed the flexibility, the puzzles, because research is essentially a puzzle. You have to try and solve an issue related to that. And then I started to see the long-term benefits of what research has done, because essentially everything around us is research. You know, like even looking at computer engineering, the iMac I'm on, the Mac Pro I presume that you're on, the Zoom calls, that all came from research. You know, the food that we eat now, the diets, the nutrition, all came from research. So I thought it would be fun, first of all. I thought it would be a fun area to go in. I know it's not easy, you know, having been in it for many years now. I knew it'd still be fun. Every day is not the same. There's always different challenges, different experiments, different things to solve and issues to solve. And I enjoyed the flexibility that came with it. You know, I've never wanted to be set in a routine of just 9 to 5. You know, with research, it changes. Everyone should have a structure. There has to be a balance between. It has to be a nice structure, but there shouldn't be that. Oh, as soon as it finishes 5, that's it. I can't do any more work. And if you say you've got some more time, you should feel that you should want to. And I think one of the biggest things was that with research, you're measured on kind of your outputs, so not your time, if that makes sense. So with a lot of other jobs, it's about how much time you clock in. You know, you can be there for 8 hours and you probably do a work that equates to 1 hour. Whereas with research, and it shouldn't be like this, and I hope viewers who are listening who are researchers, and I hope this applies to you, that there's some times where you may only work for a few hours, but you got so much done. And other days where you've got longer experiments that take 10, 12 hours, and that's fine, you know, so there's to and fro. So by the time I was in my third year, I said, okay, I didn't want a repetitive job. I wanted to pursue myself, so I wanted to develop further. and the PhD was a nice fit and was thankful for that.
No, that's really interesting. I think it draws a lot of attention to research, the flexibility you were saying, because as a researcher and academic, you are very busy. But as you were saying, you're based off the amount of work you're putting in. It's not so much a 9-to-5 job, because regardless if you even do work, you're still going to get paid. Whereas, I guess, somewhat in research, you need to keep on applying for grants. You need to keep on publishing research. It's a different ball game. And there's many things we can learn from this as individuals anyway. And I think it's really important. But one of the things you said there as well is you've had times where even the 10, 12-hour periods of non-stop work, you've often found that it might not have always been efficient as doing it before. So how do you overcome that?
Yeah, so what I meant by that was, if you were to look in a week, and if you were to quantify it in terms of hours worked versus work done, sometimes as a researcher you plan your experiments where Monday, Tuesday, you're preparing stuff for the main experiment. And it might not actually take that long. You have to prepare solutions, reagents, some mini experiments that are in readiness for that big main experiment. So what I meant by that is sometimes your week is never going to be, every day is the same in terms of hours. Now, if you were to look at another job, you're there same time in the morning, you finish the same time at night, in the evening, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, whatever. And it's that structured routine from Monday to Friday, no matter what happens. But with research, it accounts for that flexibility, because some of the experiments you can't do in a 9-to-5 structure.
Yeah.
It takes longer than that. So it allows you to say, okay, if you were to be really pedantic, you got that in 10 to 12 hours, and I've only done maybe 3 or 4 hours beforehand. But it's not looking at research as the mindset, oh, how many hours I've done. It's more the work and the output that you've generated week in, week out. So, you know, what I've enjoyed when I was a PhD student, that I used to do a lot of work during the evenings when the laboratory was quiet. You know, I myself had the flexibility to do so. And not everybody does, of course. But I read that sometimes I would be in the lab for 2 hours and then rest of the day I'm writing. And on other days I was in the lab for 8-10 hours. And I was enjoying it, because I'm sure we'll come into in this conversation that a true researcher doesn't see it as work. You know, I've never seen research as work. I've enjoyed the when you get an interesting result, you know, it's quite fascinating. Like, you know, in example, in your PhD, that elderberry did this or blackcurrant did that. It's like, wow, okay, that's quite interesting. I don't see that as work personally. And because I don't see it as work, I don't see the amount of hours of, because as you know from discussions we had before, you know, I worked crazy hours on my PhD, like, you know, 6-7 days a week, and it made me who I am now. I'm very grateful for that. But I never looked at it, oh, look, I work this many hours, so therefore I should be concentrated. I never see it like that. And I know other people may see their job like that, but personally, I've never seen research as that type of work. It is work, of course, but I've never seen it like that.
Yeah, and I want to make sure we're not getting too confused now between, let's say, a lecturer who's got contract hours and a PhD student who I'd say is more flexible.
I would say, sorry to interrupt, but I would say that between the two, when you look at a researcher, you know, every researcher wants to aspire, predominantly not all, aspire to that permanent lectureship, because that permanent lectureship gives you a bedrock where you can be essentially as flexible as you want. You know, that's what many people like aspire to. When you're a PhD student, it's all about grafting, you know, hours and then experiments and then churning data, etc. And it's entirely up to you as a person how best you organize your time.
Yeah.
Now, and I think that's quite a beautiful gift to have, because not many people can have that time. You know, some people like prefer to work early morning, some work late night, some work weekends. And doing research allows you to have flexibility, whereas lectureship is completely dependent on you, because as long as you teach, you're either submitting grant, etc., it's about how you structure your time. So yeah, there is slight disparity between the two, but both have some form of flexibility. I think it's the key element.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I completely agree. I think that's so true. And it is brilliant. I'm currently doing my PhD, for anyone not listening. And yeah, it's fantastic that you do have this flexibility. As long as you're doing somewhat work and at least you're getting data for weekly meetings or and then how often you're meeting your supervisors. I think that's the most important thing. So you have that choice, which is great. And you said, why do you think then that you managed to get this so well with organizing your time?
I think because when I started to see myself in the work environment, I used to get really agitated with being under time constraint, meaning that it wasn't about the pressure side, it's just that it was annoying that when I used to work part-time at the cinema, at Shoke in Leicester, whilst I was doing my PhD. And it was completely contrast in terms of work, because I was contrary to like this many hours in the day. And I did everything in maybe half the time, but I still had to wait. I couldn't leave. And that frustrated me a lot, because I was being penalized for doing the work too efficiently, if that makes sense. And I thought it was a waste of my time then. Like going forward, for example, if I contracted this many hours and the movie showings were playing, and you know, got everything done, everything's clean, everything's organized, everything's done, and I still have to wait around. And I knew that many other roles and jobs were similar, where you're contracted for a certain amount of time. And even if you do work, like one of my friends who's an accountant, I went to university with, and he was saying that they have to elongate their work, even though they're really good at it, because they won't get paid the same amount. And I found that quite sad, because you're being penalized for being too good at your job, essentially. And it should never be the case where no job should be, in my opinion, contracted about, okay, your timetable this amount of time, you cannot leave your workplace, your office space, your industry, whatever it is, no matter how quick you do the role. And then I started to realize that, okay, clearly I'm more suited to the flexible area where it's task-based. It's, again, you can't take advantage of it by, you know, lying and say that I've done it, but you haven't, because you're not contracted time-wise. But I saw that the PhD environment and lifestyle was more suited to how I worked, which was, okay, in this month I have these tasks I need to get done. So to me, how will I do it if it's this many hours or this time frame or this lifestyle or on the weekend or in between these things, as long as there's some sort of structure, some sort of routine to some degree with some flexibility. And even now, like as a postdoc with all the things that I have going on, I wouldn't be able to do that if my role was a rigid 9-to-5 role, you know. There are many people, and I want to help balance the argument as well, there are many people who prefer the rigidity. And that's great, because that's how they prefer to work, in the sense of they know, okay, that's my work time. I don't need to do anything else. As soon as I finish, I've got time with my family and my kids or other side hustles. So it's not like the other side is wrong. It's just what works for you. And because research is a lifelong passion, we read research papers in the evenings, or, you know, we look at experiments on the weekend. Because we're immersed in that kind of lifestyle. And it was a great fit for me, because it's essentially how our brain likes to work, it's how I like to work. And I never look back, because I enjoy research.
Yeah, so, I think it's really important. And it's even like for me personally, I'll have a phone call with my mother on a Sunday or something, and she'll be like, oh, why are you reading the paper today? It's Sunday. And I'm like, well, no, this is what I enjoy doing. I'm just the paper because I enjoy it. This is what I do. And I think because research gives us somewhat flexibility with our work, maybe that's why we enjoy it more. I guess research anyway is interesting. It's something, as me and you share, that we think about a lot. It's something in our minds every day. But I definitely think the added value of flexibility definitely helps. So we look at the UK, for example, now. Only 11% of people actually enjoy their day-to-day job. Like a study came out in Australia last month. I seen it on LinkedIn, and it was just a large study. And essentially they found that office jobs, if you work less hours, or sorry, the people who work less hours in office jobs tend to produce more work than more hours. So you're keeping these people in working crazy hours, and they're not producing the same amount of work. And it's a theory as well. It's called Parkinson's Law. I don't know if you've come across that.
Yeah. The time it takes to complete a task is the time that you're allocated it.
So I hope in today's society, it comes to a point where we really come away from this, because this approach of 9 to 5 just does not.
I think to add to your, I think, and again, I'll be careful how I word this, but
okay,
the pandemic has potentially shattered that notion because a lot of people have to work from home.
Yeah,
a lot of companies, industries, job sectors were forced to have their employees work from home, and they realized they were more effective. Like, for example, in the university sector, people who have, you know, obviously have children, families, kids at home, etc., they have to balance all of that, which is not easy. But they were getting the same amount, if not more, work done, but they were happier because in between their tasks, they could get other things done that they needed to do. Mm. And they weren't forced to sit behind a desk or sit behind a workplace and be chained, essentially. You know, that's not what sugar is. That you're chained to that life from 9 to 5, even though you've done the work already. And I think because of the strange situation we're in now with the whole pandemic, a lot of people working from home naturally. Overall, if I speak to some of my colleagues in the different roles I have, you know, a lot of them prefer then working at home because it's comfortable. They still get all the work they need to get done. You know, you save time on parking and travel. And there's a flexibility, hopefully, when things get better, where 1 or 2 days a week, you do come into the office to get other stuff done. You know, so there's a balance. And I think a lot of, if you were to compare it back to research, there's a potential lack of trust from certain companies and job sectors where they are scared that if they give too much freedom to the employees, they won't do the work. And the pandemic has forced them to do that anyway, whether they liked it or not. And a lot of people have now gone fully digital, like working from home. Like some of the roles, they have people from all over the world. The entire company is digital. They don't actually have an office space. And they work great, you know. So I think going back to our topic of research, I think that it's probably one of the best roles to have in terms of flexibility. But it is only if you enjoy it. Because if you don't enjoy research, it is definitely something that you would hate within a matter of a few months. And I've seen this, you know, in my time as a PhD student, I saw many who didn't enjoy the flexibility. Why? Because it was taking or eating into their other hours. Because they may not have been as passionate about research or as immersed as it. So as I mentioned to you before, the people who want work is work, that's there. Once I finish the work, that's it. I come home, I don't talk about work, I don't check my emails, I don't do anything. And that's fine because that's a role or a system that they prefer, potentially based off the role that they have, you know. So I think, although we hope many roles and many people who are watching the show at the moment who have different roles, we're probably be inclined to say that I wish I had more flexibility. But it's also what works for you. Some people prefer rigidity, some people prefer flexibility.
Yeah, I completely agree. And just adding on to that last point as well, it is difficult on times to really balance when you do have so much flexibility. People do struggle as well with this of knowing when to switch off. Mm. And that can be difficult as well. Did you ever
work-life balance? Yeah, massively. It's a learning curve. I think a lot of it is self-awareness because for my PhD, one of the biggest regrets I had is that I didn't have really a work-life balance. It was too work-focused and I lost in life, you know. I became very ill. I wasn't looking after myself, essentially. And although that may be from a good intention of being so driven and because of all the issues I had to face during my PhD, I didn't look after myself as much as I would have if I was to go back in time now and do it all over again. And part of that freedom becomes accountability because then it's up to you how you look after that time. Right, rigidity is that you've got that time, that's it. You don't have to worry about it because you're timetable for this. Whereas more freedom within research requires more self-awareness. And I think it was more trial and error for me personally during my PhD. It was more, I would only check emails. I would try and compartmentalize things that I would do this during this time, this during this time, that during that time. And have some sort of routine. Because within this flexibility, there needs some sort of structure. Rigidity and routine are very different things. With routine, it can change, but at least you're doing something consistently. You know, whereas in the morning, you got that, in the evening, you got this. And with my work-life balance towards the end of my PhD, it was more, this time is allocated for that, this time is allocated for that. It's non-negotiable. I think now, if I was to look at myself now, with all the different emails addresses that I've got for all the different roles that I do, I allocate time for each thing, and it's non-negotiable. So things don't overlap. And when I get to this point, when I finish the task, that's it. I tell myself that is it. Carry on tomorrow. I think a lot of it is about telling yourself to stop. Because it's not like you feel guilty. If you stop, that means you're not doing enough work. You know, if I stop now, then I might lose track of this. So that fear of potential insecurity, you know, which is obviously sometimes a problem. So one of the biggest takes for me for the work-life balance was self-awareness. You know, look at when you are most productive in a day. You have to try it. Yeah? It's like doing experiment on yourself. Yeah, for those who are researchers, it's experiment on yourself. Do the same task in the morning and then the week time during the evening. What works better? You know, if you turn off your phone or you do this, what works better for you? There's many different principles of working, like Pomodoro sessions for if you're studying, you know, a 4-hour work week if you're doing like some experiments or something. See what works for you. You know, I genuinely don't think there's a one size fits all approach for all research. You know? Some used to write during the day, experiments during the evening for a few days, and then after that, they got a break. You know, some used to work like 4 days and then the rest of the time they're off. Some used to have, you know, 8 hours a day and then used to carry on till Saturday, and then Sunday is nothing. Mm-hmm. Like everything's off. What works for you? You know, so that's where we go back to our point about the whole task focus. If it's task focused and you achieve your participant collection or your experimental design, whatever, decide. Experiment on yourself. And I think one of the biggest problems I have when I speak to students is they don't know because I haven't tried yet. It's as simple as that. You don't know because you haven't experimented on yourself during your time. You know, what works for me, it might not work for you. But I've figured it out in my time that this is probably the best, most optimal way that I work from trial and error. So I think work-life balance is about experimenting.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. One of the things I was speaking to another researcher last week called Brad, who's a neuroscientist, and he was saying that he was really glad that he'd done his master's, his integrated master's, just because that one extra year really allowed him to understand if he really wanted to go into research. And I think this is a similar principle with you in what you're saying is we can guide undergrads, or, you know, lecturers can guide undergrads how should be the most effective strategy. Mm-hmm. But it's about putting it all on the table and then allowing them to find what works best for them. It's the same as like nutrition, diet, exercise, like all these different things. Like some people, I love going for a run. Some people might prefer swimming instead. It's all about finding what works best with you. And I think that's the same with the PhD. You can do as much research looking at what's the best strategy to complete the PhD, but it's all about trial and error. Unless you try that, you're not going to know.
And everybody's different, you know, even within the same research group. You know, I think when sign them a good professor or a good academic is that they know each PhD student works maybe slightly differently. And being aware of that, you know, that some, because they have a family and they can't work late nights, so they come early mornings.
Yeah.
Some who maybe don't have as much responsibilities but have to have another job because their funding doesn't cover everything, they might do more work during the weekend, which a lot of researchers, even academics that I work with, said they used to get their best work done on the weekends because nobody else was there. It's like the lab was there. But not everybody can do that. So it's purely any, again, even though this is research work, any job you have now, it's all about experimenting what works for you. Like even, for example, the time you sort out emails, time you do the tasks, time you sort out tasks given to you by other people, you have to figure out over time. You get guidance from people who have experience. Again, end of the day, like what I share, what I try to share is my experience on things. So people are more, okay, that's how you did it, or these are the options that you have. Let me try and see what worked for me. You know, I think it's a marker for life in general that everybody's different. And that's fine, that's great. You have to figure out over time what works for you. And even that comes to doing a PhD itself. Some people have found that a PhD is not for them. And that shouldn't be seen as bad, or that person's a failure, or they couldn't finish. Because it's very tragic to have that mentality, because he or she or whoever that person may be phenomenal at something that you might not be.
Yeah.
Like there are things I am awful at when it comes to, you know, tasks and stuff like that. Somebody else is amazing at it. It's like, oh wow, I wish I could learn. With a PhD is the same thing, you know. Some people might be great at this job and not that. You know, some people, research may not be for them, but something else may. And they find out they actually enjoy that more. So as much as we big up research because we're passionate about it, we have to understand this. It's not for everybody. You have to understand as well, to balance the argument, that it's a tough life as well. It's not easy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
As much as you talk about the benefits of flexibility, the requirement of you is a lot compared to other roles. Even though you finish at 5, when there's stuff we still have to go on because we've got other things to do, other things to prep for, other things to sort out. If you're looking into, you know, and money and research is probably not the way to go, because we say time and time again, the amount of money you can earn in the industry is probably way more. You know, like my friends who finished biomed and went into industry, by the time I finished my PhD, they had savings and houses, like, you know, could buy a house already. And I was like, I was just trying to make ends meet still, you know, because I didn't get paid for my PhD, as I mentioned to you. So if you're going into research, you know, we'll come into that in our discussion today about scholarships and, you know, how best to look at it. You have to go into research because you enjoy it, first of all. It's as simple as that. You enjoy the research. And if that's not there, it can be difficult.
Yeah, definitely. Really interesting. I want to know why you decided to stay at De Montfort. Was there any reason for that? Was there any other...
If I was to look back now with the experience and the confidence I have now, my PhD was different because I designed the topic based off my undergraduate dissertation. And I formed a PhD project and as a proposal. And I went finding supervisors who would supervise me. Who would say, look, my undergraduate supervisor, it almost became my first supervisor, but I said, this is something that's quite interesting. I'm interested in doing research. What if we, because I was doing a part-time job in one of the medicinal chemistry labs in the university. I don't know if you remember, front runner placement, I think before your time. So these were like little mini 6 month placement you do part-time, but you gain experience. And I was doing it in medicinal chemistry and I found it quite enjoyable. It's pretty good. So I thought, why don't I combine my topic of anti-angiogenic therapy with my new passion of medicinal chemistry and could I form a PhD around it? And lo and behold, we got funding to fund the PhD itself, obviously not me. And it seemed like a good fit. I knew the supervisors quite well. I knew the area and I said, okay, seems quite good. However, looking at, you know, again, I wouldn't change anything because of how I am now is through all the difficulty I faced. I would have not rushed into it as much as I did. But I was fearful, if I don't get this, I didn't want to go into a master's, I didn't want to spend money again to go into a master's. I thought I was quite capable of going into a PhD because of how research clued up I was during my time as a third year. But I would probably look at other areas, so other universities, if I was to go back now. But I wouldn't change anything because of how I am now, where I am now, what I was able to achieve, all that I came from being a PhD at the moment. But yeah, I think I was slightly more rushed than I wish, like, I wouldn't be. So, you know, I rushed myself a bit more than I should have, if I was to be perfectly honest. You know, I didn't want to do a master's, and this was a PhD opportunity there and then. I was like, perfect, okay, cool, crack on. Funny enough, that I got a interview to have the fully funded scholarship at the moment, to the highest scholarship you can get. And I had an interview for it, but I didn't know the research that well at the time because, you know, it was new. And that kind of hindered me in the interview process. And because with drug discovery, it takes 10, 15 years, you know, to recuperate revenue. It probably wasn't a good, like, fit maybe for the university. I don't know the reasons why I wasn't awarded that. But what was upsetting, and I think this is useful advice for researchers or who want to become researchers, is we were under the impression that if I didn't get, so there are three options, this full-fledged, amazing scholarship, number one, a full bursary scholarship, number two, and then the fees-only scholarship, which is what I ended up getting. So we were under the impression that if we didn't get number one, we would automatically get number two, which is essentially, I think, I we were told, and my supervisors were told, that if I didn't get this fully fledged, which is called a high class scholarship at the time, we would get the full bachelor's scholarship, so stipend, PhD fees paid for, job done. But within a day, I got told I didn't get awarded that scholarship. And the full bursaries were only for ready-made projects. So projects that supervisors have put together that people can have. But because I made a project myself, I didn't apparently fit the criteria. So I was misinformed before this, which was really obviously frustrating. So I went from, like, I think, what, 14K a year, obviously, which is a really good stipend, to zero. So I was not paid at all. And I was like, okay, what do I do then? You know, because I'm already in it. And then I thought, okay, this is going to be tough. And looking back, I can categorically and unequivocally say nobody should do a PhD if it's not fully funded.
Okay.
Because the amount of difficulties I had, or the thing that still hindered me now, because I had to work extra to make ends meet. And that time could have been utilized to do more research, to learn more techniques, to publish more work. And when you do a PhD, you just want to focus on that. You don't want to worry about where your money's coming from, how you're going to pay your rent or food, etc.
No.
And it was a difficult life, you know, like making ends meet was hard. Like, as I mentioned in the PhD YouTube video that I did in 2019, I was very grateful to win conference presentation. And the prize money that I got paid for my bills the next month. That shouldn't happen for PhD student. You should be able to enjoy the reaps of the reward and the hard work you did to get to win a conference presentation. But as soon as I looked at the prize money, I was like, and it was an Amazon voucher. But so I exchanged it for cash with a friend and used that cash to pay for my bills the next month. That shouldn't happen for a PhD student. And it, although I'm very grateful that, God willing, I got through, I made it my mission now to make sure other people don't go through, because you're not going to enjoy your research. I still can't believe I was more passionate about research after my PhD than before, because of the torment that I went, because of, you know, not being paid. I was the first student for my supervisors. You know, they became research inactive over a while, so then they weren't involved in the lab or there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was my PhD project design, it was all on me kind of thing. So if it went well, it's our work. If it don't, it's your problem type thing. So it was difficult. It was very difficult. And that's not. And I looked at other people who were fully funded, not having to worry about. And I was like, you know, oh, my stipend's coming in on the 26th. I'm like, I'm working late nights till 2, 3 in the morning at Showcase just to make like 40, 50 pounds. You know, I might cover the parking for my car. It's a different thing. And if you want to excel in research, that is not going to help, you know.
No.
And it's quite unfortunate. But at the same time, I'm incredibly grateful for the experience, because it made me a stronger researcher, made me a stronger person, and made me a more, again, we all have weaknesses, we all have difficulties, now we struggle, but it made me a more resilient person, you know. Made me more relentless, which is what I, you know, a friend of mine called me the relentless researcher on LinkedIn because of that mentality. That I went through all of that and I still want to do research. That shows.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
So yeah, that was difficult.
I think that'll be really good for people to hear. You know, it's not often you hear people, you know, when we look on Twitter, Instagram and stuff, there's some fantastic content out there. And whilst there is a little bit of people talking about their failures and negativities, it's not really spoken about as much.
So no, true.
It's really good to hear from people like yourself who have been through the PhD process, has got one and is now a postdoc, to really express, or to open up at least, of your failures and the issues you had and how you overcome it. Because that's what makes a person. It's, whilst it's the successes, it's about, how do you overcome the big barriers, you know?
Yeah, the difficulty.
And yeah.
A very famous analogy that I got taught, and this helped to refine me as an individual, was if you try to purify gold, you can't brush it off from the top. Like, there's impurities. You have to melt the gold to extreme temperatures and the impurities start to froth off. And we look ourselves as, you know, great people or great living human beings. And if you really want to purify yourself or develop yourself or enhance yourself, you sometimes have to go through extreme difficulties. And that's the only way it's going to gear you up to be a better individual. And I tried to see my PhD like that, that I had to go through intense difficulties to become how I am now, you know, where doing 10, 12 hour days, 7 days a week, it's not an issue because I did that many times. Having failures in my experiments is not an issue because I had many. You know, being on a budget or making ends meet or being that clued up wasn't a problem because I had to. You know, it made me more grateful. I think one of the biggest things that I have to understand is that having that lifestyle made me very grateful for everything else. Because the analogy that I used was, even though I didn't get a scholarship, I didn't get a stipend, I didn't get £1,000, you know, a year or whatever, it could have been that I didn't get a PhD opportunity at all. It's perspective, it's the way you view that. When when you hopefully share that YouTube video about my PhD journey, the side you don't see is titled, and I share, you know, I was so grateful to win all of these awards, but not many people knew all the other things I had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like my mother still suffered from severe asthma, and I used to analyze data or mark students' coursework 3 o'clock in the morning, bedside at the hospital. People don't see that. People saw the award, the research Oscar, the conference presentation I won, the doctoral college presentation. They saw all of that and it's like, oh, great. But nobody knew the intense struggles I had to get through just to even get there. And I think it really taught me about gratitude, because it could be that I didn't get opportunity at all. And imagine that, you know, that could easily have been the case, that people didn't get an opportunity to do a PhD. So it really taught me about perspective. It really taught me about that I could either focus on why did all of those people get a stipend and I didn't, and I work more hard, and it's the wrong lens to look at life. You know, I looked at least I got an opportunity and I made the most of it. I'm very thankful. And now I look at life as well, how I am now, the opportunities I have. You know, it's a gift. You have to make use of it. And yeah, that intense difficulty formed me into a better person, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing. I think the listeners really appreciate that. It is interesting what you say, though, about you wouldn't recommend people do a PhD if it wasn't funded.
Yeah.
And I do agree, because it's difficult, because for some people, they really want to do this PhD.
Mm.
And no one should, if someone wants to do something, I believe that anyone can achieve what they want. And
no, my recommendation would be that you wouldn't. But
yeah,
here's a long term bigger picture. With anything, you have to look at the bigger picture. Now look at my case, and I follow you through the trajectory of what happened, and you can see why maybe saving up for a year, then if you need to do a PhD without funds, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I obviously went straight from undergrad to PhD with no time to really save an incredible amount of money. I had to work 3 or 4 different jobs whilst my PhD. So that 8 time that I could have spent extra on learning new techniques, focusing on publishing the research, more time in the lab, more time to maybe go to conferences, more times to meet and network other people. So I was losing out on these things because I had to work. So when I got towards the end of my PhD, I could have easily published a review paper or some of my data. And I'm still trying to get stuff published for my PhD now because of all the issues I faced in my PhD on top of having to work. So it actually affects your career path and your trajectory when you can't get those things done in your PhD.
Mm-hmm.
PhD, if it's done really well, it's a great foundation. You can leap on like people that we know, for example, somebody who I admire as a hard like Stephen Bailey, for example, you know, in Loughborough University. You know, he worked with some incredible excellent people back in Exeter, and it helped him, you know, set up such incredible research in Loughborough. And I'm sure he and Mendez has had difficulties, but potentially not the difficulties that I had to face.
I
had more time to do the things that excelled you further as a researcher, you know. And as we know, you're based on the amount of stuff that you publish. And if you can allocate more time to that, the better. And if you're fully funded, you don't have to worry about where your money is coming into. You can actually use your extra time for that. But my extra time was working. So that's what I mean by it's not ideal to, and If you go to different countries, they've never heard of a fees-only scholarship. Like, it doesn't make sense. You know, there's only a handful of universities in the UK that do this. And even one of my friends, yes, called it a trap. Because you're trapped by university now to finish, you don't get paid. So you have to finish because the university is paying for your fees, even though there shouldn't be really fees for a PhD in that sense. You know, bench fees, because if you've got laboratory costs, that's fine. But if you start to see it from that view, then you start to understand why not being paid for your PhD can really hinder your process. And that's what I'm trying to get at, that I wouldn't advise anybody to do a PhD because it hinders your career path later. You know, I, with all the awards that I was very grateful to win, I wish I had more time to publish the research. It would have helped me to get an even better postdoc because we measured on that. You know, that as much as I go into postdoc interviews, I got this, I've got all that. It's all about how much that you publish. I could say that I'm one of the, you know, not that I am, but I'm an incredible researcher. I've done all of this. It's about evidence. Has your research been peer reviewed? Otherwise, I don't really kind of care what you say, type of, you know,
No,
principle.
that's true. Yeah, I agree.
So when I look at it from that point of view, it's like I wish I had the time that I spent at Showcase at 3 o'clock in the morning or all of these other jobs and open days. I wish I could do more research to publish more work because that's going to help my career, you know, but I couldn't because I didn't get paid.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing, especially if I don't know what it's like for industry, whether because between after your PhD, you have two choices. You can either go down the industry route or academia. Now, we're talking academia-wise, that's where we really need to focus on the publishing, isn't it? And yeah, I guess what you're saying, it is important. And I completely agree. I do appreciate anyone who does a PhD not funded, like fair play. That's, I respect them a lot. It shows how much someone wants it. But as you said as well, you've got to be careful that you make sure that you're not in a position where your worries, from what you're saying, should be that, okay, am I publishing or have I got data ready in, rather than worrying, okay, about bills. And you want to limit all that. I think that was one of the first things you said to me when I first came is try not to, like, just make sure you always have money just there. So you're
Not
not.
not have that as a distraction point for you. And I think, you know, with the stipends that I generally have is more than enough for accommodation costs and food and a standard of living, you know, which is perfect. And you can work other roles to, you know, to save up potentially. And I've got colleagues back at Glenfield, you know, who want to save during their PhD because the stipend is really good. You don't need to spend all that money, you know, and it's being more financially clued up and more financially aware. But you shouldn't have to worry about those things when you're doing a PhD. You know, it should be about your problem should be about, oh, I couldn't get that much data, or, you know, I got rejection from that paper or that journal, sorry. That's the type of thing that somebody should naturally go through. Again, you have supervisor difficulties, maybe personal matters as well. But, you know, I personally feel nobody should be in a case where they work so hard to win a presentation at a conference, and the awards that they got had to pay for their bills in it. Nobody should have to go through that as a PhD student because it hinders your process. You don't enjoy it as much. It's not something that somebody should have to go through, you know. So from that point of view, that's why I say that if you have, you know, potentially a rich support structure where you don't have to worry about the funding, then fine, you know, that's great. But not everybody has that luxury, you know. If you've worked for a few years, so many some people that I know, they do a PhD part, you know, and that's a whole different kettle of fish. But that shouldn't be a problem. That shouldn't have to be an issue, you know. Yes, other people that you know that went through undergrad are earning, but you shouldn't be comparing yourself to somebody else because that's a full-time work that they're doing, you know, in whatever role that they have. PhD or research is a long-term career. It's like medicine. It's a long-term career. To become a senior lecturer or professor, it takes years, you know, from blood, sweat, and tears sometimes, you know, to get there.
Yeah, I don't think you can compare it to undergrad because I feel like if you do prioritize and organize your time better, then you have that opportunity to, or you should be working side job. I've talked to many recruitment workers and they all agree as undergrads, you should have a side job. Whereas for a PhD, you should really just be, unless it's
Your
then your main aim should.
no, yeah, I think your side job, it should be as a researcher. Like your side job should be more research in a slightly different area, like new techniques, new environment, new networks, new chances of publishing, or maybe going on like an industry liaison type thing or something like that. It should be about what can I do in my 3 or 4 years that's going to drive my, whether it's industry, whether it's academia, whether it's teaching, whatever. Because the stipend should cover your basic costs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it thrives. That's how a PhD thrives. So like, I would be as harsh as saying that the university should abolish that fees-only scholarship, because for some people, it's not ideal, you know, and it really hinders your career progression. And I really want to stress that those who are looking at doing a PhD without getting paid, you know, really evaluate. I'm not saying don't do it, but really evaluate, you know, look at the long-term effects and then make a decision.
What was your motivation? Or surely it's, well, I say easier. Obviously, talking about it now, you can kind of evaluate it, look back. But what would you say during them time periods when you were struggling? What was your motivation to really overcome that?
It's something that I stress a lot and that I share as advice to researchers, which is changing mentality. So I looked at not if I finish my PhD, but when. It's a completely different mindset. If you say if, there's a kind of air of doubt, right? And you already got a defeatist mindset already. You're saying if. So I was drilling my brain to say when, because I was determined to finish. And I mentioned to you before that I looked at my Viva as a boxing. I became that determined, that relentless, that I wouldn't let anything stop me. It's about when. It doesn't matter if it takes longer, it's when. I had that narrow focus mindset of what do I need to do to get to this point, get to that point, get to that point. It was all about when. When I finish, I tell myself every day. So when I got to the Viva point, and again, going to all these difficulties that I had, you know, there's many more that I haven't, you know, even mentioned, that when I knew the Viva was the last hurdle. So this was in the most polite way possible. I knew the Viva was me versus you guys. You're here to find out if I know my research. I'm here to prove to you that it is. And I'm going to talk so much that you're going to tell me to stop talking because I know my research that much. I was that motivated because I was about when, not if I finish. Because if you finish, that means you have a hesitancy towards it. So, and it actually happened in my Viva that they were asking me questions. I was so motivated, so confident, like, because I wanted to get there. I was not arrogant. I was just confident that I knew my work that well. That I said, no, it's fine. I was going onto the whiteboard, drawing structures and chemical equations, all this to prove to you, because it was a boxing match. In my opinion, you're here to figure out if I don't know the work, if I slip up, if I'm not that, you know, clued up in this area, that area. I'm here to try and respectfully and politely prove you wrong. This is my work. This is my blood, sweat, and tears for 4 years. Nobody knows this better than I do, and I'm going to show you. It's about when I finished my PhD. And because of that, I had that mindset. I was very grateful to do so. And it's the same mentality for when I got the research Oscars, the conference presentations, all of those. It was that when, about when I finished, you know. Everything, that the little opportunities about when, this is going to help me, fine. I didn't make excuses. I think that's something else, along with the whole if-when mentality. A lot of the other signs is that stop making excuses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because I don't get... Forget that. You can't change it now. Or that person's got a stipend. Who cares? You can't change it. You know, as time's kind of becoming more... Making life more simple for myself.
Like, yeah.
Stop making excuses. Like, you know, I couldn't get this stuff. Stop making excuses. I just kept telling myself, stop it. It's not helping. Carry on with the work. What can you control? And this is another thing that I try and share and try and teach students, which is focus on what you can control. Simple as. And many, you know, very famous entrepreneurs, motivational speakers, life coaches say the same thing. Focus on what you can control. I can't control the fact that other people got stipend, or I can't control the fact that other people got bigger research groups. So why am I allowing time in my brain to focus?
Mm-hmm.
More of that time could be spent on you doing the work. or like even like little things about waiting for delivery for orders. Why am I worrying about something like that when there's nothing I can change? If it's on this way, it's on this way. Why don't I just focus on this one? It's not making excuses, you know. And naturally, as if you're looking in the world of cognitive psychology, it's about people look at the path of least resistance. Everything is a path of least. What is the quickest way to get something where it's less stress-free? It's a natural default setting. I'm like, that's not on. If I really want to excel, I have to go through hardship. So instead of evading it, I started to attack it. I started to find things that were difficult. I wanted to get through it because it made me a stronger person, you know. So when I encountered difficulties, I relished the challenge. And I look back at my PhD as, I wish I could see myself on third person to see how motivated I was, you know. That one of the quotes in my PhD, my thesis, which you can put in the link for people
to read,
was, PhD is a 4-year boxing match, but you only get to throw one punch at the end. So I'm taking hits in my PhD, left, right, and center, like, you know, I'm just winding up. I'm just winding up until my Viva. And then I'm going to throw that haymaker and that's it, you know. That's the mentality I had, because I had so many difficulties to go through. I had to wind myself up. So, you know, it's not if you finish, it's when. Focus on what you can control, because everything else isn't worth your time. And I became relentless, you know. And part of that relentlessness that I have now in different capacity was I saw everything that I have as a gift. You know, and this is probably a bit more deeper than people were probably aware of, but I saw everything I have is a gift. Whether people believe it as divine intervention or whether they believe it's just generally, I saw everything that I have as a gift, because there's billions of people around the world who would love to be in my position. They will see my position as priority. Even though I'm saying that I can't get paid, I've got this to go in, somebody else would be like, at least you can work. I can't find a job, you know? I didn't have that perspective. Somebody else could look at it and say, at least you got an opportunity. So then I realized that, hold on, if that's a mentality, I need to be the best I can be, because I need to do justice to myself, because it's still a gift. I could have not got a PhD position. At least I got a job at Showcase. At least I got to teach. You know, it's all about perspective. So when I saw everything that I have as a gift, I'm still trying to do it now, I realized that I need to be the best I can be, because otherwise it'd be an injustice to my life or to me as a person. Because there's millions and millions of people around the world who would love to take my role and be even better than me. I can't be ungrateful anymore. So that's what motivated me for further.
That's really interesting. And I think mentality around a PhD is so important. And like, even myself, I'll admit there's days where I can't help but mourn. Maybe it's just the Italian in me. I think it's I'm going to use that excuse, but I think, even I mourn on times as well.
Mm.
Sometimes you do just have to, when things aren't going right or not going your way, you really do just have to step back for a couple of minutes, have a day off, just, you know, stop what you're doing and really think, why am I in this position? Why am I not happy? Or why am I frustrated? If it's something I can't control, I need to learn. I need to have a mechanism to stop this from happening, because I need to focus. The only thing I should be worried about is what I can control. Like, because one of my best mates as well, Craig Patterson, he was on the podcast as well.
Yeah.
And now he's not got a funded PhD either.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he is, instead of just mourning about it, he's just got on with it and he's bashing it out.
Yeah.
He published a paper the other day in Impact Factor 9. He's only in second year.
Wow, that's incredible.
First author. It's a cracking paper.
Mm.
You know, he could have easily used the excuses of...
Exactly.
And yeah, even people, you know, I'm funded and I mourn. So I need to stop mourning and just crack on with it. Just really appreciate the position.
All about perspective. You know?
Yeah.
And everybody has things behind the scenes that nobody knows about, like their own internal struggles, other things. So they say, you know, comparison is a thief of joy, because I stopped comparing.
Mm.
Like, it's not healthy for me. Why am I like other people are doing this or doing that. I need to look at my own situation. What can I do that's the best of my situation? You mentioned it before about, you know, taking a step back. And that's probably one of my biggest regrets during my PhD, that when times were difficult, everything's a learning curve, that I did the opposite, where I sped up instead of slowing down. And it was at my deficit, because then the experiments wouldn't work properly. I was trying to catch up because that was an issue. And as a result, all the things that I did after that became a problem. Like, the experiments didn't work, the data didn't make sense, and I wasted materials and time. Whereas if I had the confidence and understanding, which I do now, to step back, analyze. And that's why I say being a researcher, it is such a gift in terms of the mindset, because the way you look at life, you're so drilled as to analyze things methodically, looking at the issues in a nice systematic pattern. You can do that for your life as well. You analyze, where did I go wrong? What thing was causing the issue, like we do in our experiments? What thing is the stimulant that affects this change in the cells? Look at our bodies and our mind. What thing in my life is affecting my behavior after, you know? And when you step back, a famous quote I got from a movie called The Shooter was, slow is smooth, smooth is fast. Now, I don't know whether there's a previous quote about it, but it's where I heard it from. And you can get inspiration from anywhere, right? And when I heard this, I was like, wow, that was profound. Because when you go through things nice and methodically, it may appear slow, but you minimize mistakes. And then long term, you're actually faster. You know, so slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And I try to adopt this in research where, you know, it's not about guns blazing, getting more research done, because within a few weeks, everything's gone to pot, like it doesn't work. Yeah. If you take a few more weeks and everything's ready, you've actually achieved more than the other person, even though it's perceived as slower, right? You got more data organized, the data is more spot on, it's already analyzed, you've already fitted it into a paper format, etc. All of that's done, even though it's perceived as slower. So slow is smooth is fast. So I think that's really that helped.
Completely agree with that. You know what I'm like? I'm like this all the time. Oh, what to do next? What to do next? Even when I first came to De Montfort, just trying to, I'm going to try finishing a PhD in a week. And I was like, whoa. Slow down now.
It's hard though. It's not easy. It's not easy because I was the same. You know, I'm like at Glenfield, because I knew January we're going to be going into lockdown. You could see, you know, that it's going to happen. I did like 4 weeks of lab work in a week. You know, 12-hour days. But I had no choice. I had to do it, and I planned a few weeks in advance to get to that stage, so then I could do it methodically. If I just decided now I want to do it, the amount of things that can go wrong is endless, but I planned ahead. So slow is smooth is fast. So I built up the notion to do it all in that week, because you have to prepare things and do things. Because if I waited till January, I know I wouldn't be able to be in the lab because of restrictions and issues. Yeah, it's really been a valuable lesson for me, even in life, slow is smooth, about anything. Don't rush into it. Because again, being driven and rushing are two different things. And a lot of people think it's the same, but it's not. If you're driven, you can be driven and you go through them methodically, right? But if you're rushing into it, it's like you don't have much of a plan, or you haven't organized it properly, or you're just like not thinking clearly, and then it becomes a problem.
Yeah. When you were doing the PhD, did you have many friends to bounce off with?
Towards the end, I did, but during the first two and a half years, I wasn't in a research group, you know? I was quite very lonely. That's another thing to add to the difficulties I had. You know, I didn't have people to bounce off. Who are doing, like, naturally when you're in a research group, you have a few people who are doing similar work, not the same, but similar work. So you become more of like a little family, you know? You're there together, you bounce off, you have a chat, you go for maybe lunch together or whatever. I didn't have that. Only towards the end when another supervisor came on board and his student came on board, Jay. Then I had some sort of a kind of bond. But by then it was like I was already playing catch up with all the issues I had. So I didn't get to enjoy it as much, unfortunately, as much as I would have if it was in my first year. So I had, and I got friends that, you know, we catch up now who were friends in the PhD room, you know, in the community kind of desk space. But in terms of the PhD itself, the research, I didn't have much. Many of my friends were from the different research groups. And that's naturally happens, you know, you meet people in the building or in like socials and classes or whatever. But in terms of the PhD, the research itself, I only had essentially Jay. I had another friend, Hajara, who was more the kind of chemistry side, you know. But again, it was different areas. We were working in different labs. I didn't have somebody in the same lab as me doing work side by side that I could bounce off. I was only until I got to the more pharmacology side of things when then I met Jay and then we did more work, which I then started to enjoy. But by then, it was a bit late, you know. But again, he's a great friend and he helped a lot, you know, to get help me get through to where I am. So, yeah, I wish I couldn't help it. Again, one thing I couldn't control. I couldn't just suddenly grant somebody to come automatically to be a PhD student within my research group. And that, I think, I underestimated how big of an issue that was. Being a lone researcher as a PhD student in the areas you don't know that well, because I moved from biomedical science to more medicinal chemistry and then back to a bit more biomedical science towards the end. So yeah, it was a very lonely place, I would admit. It was a very lonely place, you know. I didn't have a postdoc either, you know, at that time to lean on. And so it was, yeah, it was a bit of a lonely period.
Yeah, it just shows how important it is when you are lab-based, we'll say, type research student. It's really important to make sure that when you are looking for a PhD that you find supervisors who are just as keen as you to produce research. Yeah.
And who are also research active, who are actively doing research themselves, you know, who are in the area themselves, you know, who are actual supervisors, you know, who are like there and then, you know, one of my supervisors was a medicinal chemistry technician by trade. That was his actual role, but he was my supervisor. He didn't have the same time as supervisors do to dedicate. So I didn't get as much teaching as I was hoping to towards the first. Because the first year, you need to be nurtured. You're molded, you're taught all the things, you're guided as well. And then slowly they pull off the restraints and then you go more independently on your own. But I didn't have that same, again, that's the way I was supervised. You know, now that I supervise people. But then it was just that, get that done, here's that asset done. I couldn't have regular meetings to discuss things. It was always like quick 2-3 minutes, and I couldn't discuss everything in that 2-3 minutes, you know. No. I had to wait weeks to discuss something, and that used to take time, used to affect my progress. But now I try to be that supervisor that I wish I had, you know. And again, I'm not here to now to slag off because I learned so much from myself, but I'll be first to admit that I wish there were other things that were different. And one of them was with the chemistry side of my PhD. I didn't have as much support, you know, until towards the end, which was a shame.
This discussion, it really shows the importance of, whilst it is your own PhD and essentially you're trying to focus on how much work you're producing, you really need to, how can I say, create a good setting.
Yeah.
To make the PhD work happen, you know, having regular meetings with the supervisors, making sure that, you know, you're in a research setting where you've got other PhD students around. So all these things, they really do add up after time.
They make a profound impact. And even part of it is also looking after the PhD student. And it's something that's very underrated. It's looking after the person.
Mm-hmm.
Like one side is the PhD side, they have to get the work done. The person is being there as a supervisor and as a, you know, a friend in need or person of again, keeping it all professional, but when the person, you ask them, everything okay, how's it going? It's not just full work related. When the person's going through difficulty, you're there to help, not just to signpost them that look. Go seek that department for counseling or this or that. You know, you're there to offer support, you're there to help the person, you know, and it should never be a hostile environment. Where sometimes if the student's not behaving well, then fine, you got to be firm to look, get on with it, crack on. This is what needs to happen. And you're focusing on the wrong thing potentially. But if you look at, like, if there was to be another study, and if you go on Twitter, etc., and you look at, like, those students who really excelled, naturally, they would say their supervisors were incredibly helpful. You know, you don't often find a person who is very rare, but can happen, where they excelled, but their supervisors were really harsh and difficult, etc. And, you know, they didn't enjoy it. Because a lot of them then go into academia because those people who do enjoy it, because their supervisors made a really nice atmosphere. And I got that towards the end, but there was a lot of damage done already.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly important. You even look at the literature as well. There's tons of studies saying there's a strong association between people doing well in academia who are co-authored with their supervisors doing their PhD.
Yeah. So
if you're publishing good work and you're like first, second author with your supervisor, you're more likely to do better in... Yeah. And that's quite scary when you think about it, because you could be someone who's super driven in a position where you've not got active supervisors, but then someone else might be just be in the right research group. This is quite scary when you think of it like that.
That's what I mean by trajectory. It really affects your career progression about, you know, going back to what I mentioned about funding, which can affect, and then also about the supervisors, you know. If they're not actively looking for grants or looking for more research or looking at the latest papers, that can hinder your work, you know.
Mm.
And the worst thing you want to do is be in a research where it's already obsolete. You know, that's the most tragic thing ever for a PhD, where you get it first in your PhD and already it seems like the research is redundant. So it's not that effect, like the papers that you do or try to publish or the work you're going into, and, you know, and you want that support to motivate you. You know, you shouldn't be all just on your own. Supervisor should be like, look, why don't we get that work done so we can get into a potential paper, you know. So it's different for everybody. It really is, you know, across the world, you know, the way PhDs are done are very different. But a PhD should be there to support. You know, first and foremost.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to... I'm trying to get someone on from the States just to do a podcast. Okay. I'm really interested just to see what they do differently in comparison with us in the UK. But yeah, no, I think it's definitely important. And I think what can sometimes be the issue with this as well, I'm just going back into undergrad and masters, because most people who are doing a PhD are normally achieved quite a lot academically, you know, either you've got a high 2-1 or a first at both. Mm. Because you're used to that high achievement, sometimes people can just rush into a PhD. And that's why the good break.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, because a lot of people misinterpret what a PhD is. You know, they think it's like another degree, like an advanced degree, but it's a whole different ballgame. You know, it's completely different. Although it's seen as a degree, I think it's everything but a degree in the classical sense, you know, of going to classes, doing exams. You know, you see many jokes on Twitter about those who are in undergrad looking at PhD and saying, oh, so you don't have exams, you know, or is it just coursework, you know, because they are unaware of the lifestyle or what it actually is, you know. And, you know, it's way more than saying it's not, oh, you don't have exams, you know. It's a different thing altogether. You know, it's a different environment, essentially. It's a completely different environment. The amount of commonalities between undergrad and PhD are so minimal, you know, there isn't, you can't even really compare or contrast, you know. It's really a whole different ballgame.
And it can, you know, it can really affect you, it can really break you down as a person if you've not got certain things in place, like we've mentioned throughout this whole podcast, I think. So it's really important to make sure, as you said, mental health, well-being is important, your physical activity. Make sure all these are important whilst doing a PhD. Because even like the top academic achievers in undergrad and stuff can really struggle a PhD. Yeah. A PhD can break anyone if you let it.
I say that any PhD breaks you down, and those who are the best are the ones who can put themselves back together again for the Bible. And It is remarkable as to, no matter what PhD somebody's doing, there's always a commonality where it gets really difficult. Sometimes you don't know where you're going. Experiments don't work or things are not fitting. You go around in circles. It pulls you apart. You go crazy. The amount of times this happened to people, even though they have completely different PhDs, they're on a different side of the planet as well. It's the same, and it's remarkable as to, like, the unwritten rule of the PhD is supposed to break you down to your bare bones, and you're supposed to put yourself back together. I know that sounds like really deep and epic, but I see it so often that it's a real test of patience and character, that even those who are in the best of institutes with the best of funding and the best of resources still go through the same. You know, it's like, how? Why does the PhD always have that mentality? Again, there are rarities where people just sail through. But like, if you sail through, you don't really learn much. You know, like, it's, you know, some, I think I read a recent quote, I think earlier today, you know, one of the best gifts you can have is a mistake, because if it went perfect, you didn't learn anything. You know, I was like, PhD is all about that. You know, research is all about that. You learn, you trial and error. Everything is experimental. It's trial and error. You try something, it doesn't work. Okay, why didn't it work? And I think one thing to help the audience as well to learn is that there's never a bad experiment. It's always you learn something or you learn something different. You know? And I think something that I learned towards the end of my PhD is that you don't find more answers, you just think of more questions. You know?
These quotes, brilliant.
And now I realized towards when I finished my Viva, I had more questions to myself about research. Why? Because I was becoming a better researcher. It wasn't always about finding the answers, but what questions can I ask? Because at the end of the day, your PhD will give you the requirement to ask new questions.
Mm-hmm.
It will open the door to more questions, you know. Like, for example, the ever-changing area, my current area of severe asthma. Like, the, you know, adding a bit of science now, looking at the immunological profile of patients who have severe asthma is ever-changing. Like, now you can't just say asthma. There's, like, so many different subtypes. Eosinophilic asthma, non-eosinophilic, allergic, type T2 asthma, non-T2-dependent asthma, you know, all these variations. So then when you do research, it helps you then to ask more, much better questions. You know, I think the sign of a good research post-PhD is that you're really good at asking questions. You know, I think that's oh, wow, that's really interesting. I never thought of it like that. So when you go to like a conference presentation, you ask questions like, oh, whoa, I never thought of it like that. You learn to connect more dots. You know, you look at a professor, they can connect things left, right, and center.
Yeah.
You know, that you couldn't even think of, because they're really good at seeing information and asking the right questions that will trigger really useful research. You know, and that's what research should be about, is asking the right questions.
I completely agree. It's always about that. You know, when you do like an assignment at undergrad, you do it, you probably don't think about that again. You're just like, oh,
no.
In research, you're always thinking, what? Okay, I've done this. What could I have really done? I think that's so important to have that mentality. It really shows a passionate researcher, I believe.
Yeah, and I think, again, to reiterate, it helps in life. Like when, for example, you're stuck in traffic, as a researcher like I do, it's like, I actually start to analyze what could be the possibility that I'm stuck in traffic. You know, could it be an accident? Or is it the weather? Is it this? I'm not realizing the traffic is going along. When somebody else potentially might be just moaning. Because whenever I see things, I start to think of what questions can I ask? And when somebody is going through difficulties, what questions can I ask based on the information I've been given? That's what research is about. You do experiments, whatever they may be, you generate information, knowledge, and then you ask the right questions. One thing I learned from my boss at Leicester is, when you read a research paper, first thing should be what is missing. Like everything else, what is, when you read it, what do you see that are gaps that are missing? What isn't there? Get that first, then you can see, okay, what is there? What is useful? You ask the right questions, you know. And I reiterate that, you know, a lot of it is about, and I hope you through like even your YouTube channel and my YouTube channel on these aspects, it's about how can you apply research to life? Like just the general lifestyle of a researcher. Many things that I wish I did on LinkedIn before I went on to YouTube, and all my videos, you know, which I want to share, and conversations like this, is about how many things from research and the lifestyle of a researcher can you use in life to be a better person. You know? And the way I see, like, you know, when I get letters or when I get things through the post or when I get emails and queries, I see being a researcher how much it helps in life. You know, the way you see these things, you see it in a different lens. Completely, yeah, and it's real privilege, it's real joy, definitely.
No, Amir, thank you so much for that. We've covered so much in this podcast. I think we're going a bit over time now, about an hour and a half. So that'll be a lovely episode. No, Amir, I'd like to just say thank you so much for coming on the podcast. If there's anything, if there's just one more thing you could leave the listeners with, what would that be?
In research, for me, was the most painful but the most beautiful thing I've ever done. And it's made me a better person, left, right, and center. And I think for anybody who's going into research, first you have to see that, would you enjoy it? You know? And for me personally, it's been the greatest joy of my life in the sense of, you know, work, of so-called work. And I think one of the best statements that I would, again, it's in my PhD thesis, and this is the thing that I actually want to leave for audience, is we all have a potential that far exceeds what our minds can imagine. What we lack is the belief that we have it and the desire to utilize. I didn't know I had the capabilities of doing a PhD in all of these, but clearly I did. I didn't take no magic pill, no magic formula. The only thing I was missing was the belief, you know, because obviously hindsight is a beautiful thing, but clearly I had the potential because otherwise I wouldn't have finished. But what was lacking is the belief. So how can you tap into a potential if you don't believe you have it? You know, and I think a lot of it is strive from self-belief. You know, because you will be amazed at what you are capable of. You know, and again, to reiterate, to leave as a last punchline, I was born with speech and listening difficulties. I'm now talking to you on a podcast. I now teach, I lecture, conference presentations that I've thankfully won. Who thought back then, if somebody told me that you're going to get a PhD, like, I would have broken hand. I was like, what do you mean? Like, I didn't have the capabilities. So my last kind of point is your potential is based on how much you believe in yourself. You know, end of the day, nobody's going to do it for you. And as harsh as that sounds, as scary as it sounds, nobody's going to do it for you if you don't do it yourself. You know, you have to believe in yourself first. That's the biggest thing that I hope to leave for the audience.
Thank you so much, Amir. Really appreciate that. Another thing as well, do you want to just tell the listeners where can they find you on social media and stuff?
Yeah, so I have a few accounts. I actually set up a little platform known as Research Tribe, where people, if they want tips and advice in depth for their research, I'm hoping to offer kind of writing services in terms of, you know, courses or little workshops to help people write in a better way, think in a better way, like things that I mentioned in this podcast. So if you email address is amir@researchtribe.org. The Twitter account is research_tribe, and then the YouTube channel is my name. Feel free to contact me in any of those formats. I'm happy to, if you want to discuss research or just get my opinion on something or want my help, feel free. I'm more than happy to do so. So yeah,
I'll definitely leave the links in description as well. But no, thank you so much, Amir.
No problem. No, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Definitely. Good. Hi everyone, hope you all enjoyed that podcast episode. If you are a PhD student or currently working as a researcher and you'd like to come on the podcast, please message me on Instagram or any other way and we can arrange a podcast episode. Thank you. If not, I'll see you next time.